Hi, this is John DeLancey, and you are listening to the GeekCast Radio Network.
People keep asking if I'm back, and I haven't really had an answer. But now, yeah, I'm thinking I'm back.
Guess who's back, 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 back again? Shady's back. Tell a friend. Guess who's back? Guess who's back?
I'm back, and I'm better than ever. Got a knack for making things better. Face facts, 'cause your opinion don't matter.
We are back, baby. We are fucking back.
We're back.
Yeah. Classic. We are back.
That's
we
right.
Are back.
I guess now it's time. But you came back for good.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of The Cinema Geeks. I am one of your Cinema Geeks, Optimus Solo, and joining me today for this back in action record is Movie Revolt Dan. Hello.
Hey, long time no talk to.
Yes, long time no talk to each other, long time no talk or talk for anyone who listens to us still, if there is anybody left. But I've gotten a few DMs or PMs or whatever you call it, depending on what app you're on or whatever, that's like, hey, you guys ever coming back? So here's the answer. We're back. We're doing an episode. We're doing that thing again. Just the two of us today. No Amanda, no Matt. They are off doing other things, but Dan and I are back to do what we try to do every year, at least get some of the greatest hits going here. And we're going to be talking today about our favorite films of 2019. Just to open up, Dan, you want to give everybody an idea or a brief snapshot of your 2019 and how it related to movies and your movie going experiences?
Yeah, well, I didn't watch as many films as I would definitely like to in 2019. Having a second kid kind of made it harder to get out to the theaters. I did see a lot of movies. Mostly it was just rewatching stuff late at night as they were doing feedings for the first few months. As you'll get that experience in a you know, 6 months from now or so.
Right.
So look forward to that. And then usually like January is when I cram in a bunch of movies as we gear up for a list like this. But then we had like the literal plague hit our house. Both my kids got the flu twice, got both flus, A and B, because you want the matching set. My son got scarlet fever because that's back in the rage. Yeah, and then my wife got the flu twice and pneumonia, and my youngest got pneumonia. So there was a lot of sickness going on and not a lot of movie watching. But luckily, I was still able to catch in a lot of the bigger films. I did go to each year EMC Best Picture Showcase. I was able to see all the Best Picture nominations, minus the Netflix films on the big screen. I had to watch those at home. But I was able to catch up with a bunch. There's, you know, luckily we live in a day and age where, I mean, so many movies are streaming and things like that, but there might be some bigger films like Uncut Gems I mentioned and Knives Out, which I really want to see, which I feel like would probably make my list knowing past work from those directors and my tendency to enjoy their work. But still, I was really happy with my top 10. To me, it's a pretty astounding year when I have a 10 this strong and I still have a number of movies I've yet to watch. But yeah, how about yourself?
I too, and very much enjoyed 2019. I don't feel like it was a bad year at all. I probably could go at least, you know, 20, 30 deep and still be happy with picks that would be within that. Probably near the 40, 50 mark is where it starts to kind of plateau a little bit for me. But I had a lot of films that I quite enjoyed in it. Seemed like a lot of variety for me. A lot of films that were different genres, different types of things. I mean, there is some themes, I guess, with some of the films that I saw in 2019, and maybe we'll get into some of that. But yeah, I was pretty pleased with most of the year as a whole. There's some that I haven't seen. I did not get to do the Best Picture Showcase, and I think the one that I missed on there was Little Women. I have not seen Little Women. I also did not see A Portrait of a Lady on Fire, and a couple other ones.
That's only going like wide now. So right. Yeah, I've yet to see that. Yeah.
So. And I was talking to you a little off air, but there's an abnormal amount, more than ever, I think, in my life, of films that I've seen partial amounts of. So quite a few films that I either saw 2/3 of or half of. And it's not because they were like bad or anything like that. It was just timing wise, or some of the times Amanda didn't want to continue. So I was like, well, I'll catch the rest of that on my own, and just haven't got around to it. So I'm sure the list will evolve like it always does as we go through time and look back at different things, which might be something we're doing soon here on Cinema Geeks, looking back a little bit. But today is all about 2019. Any other caveats you want to give out before we start knocking down our number 10s?
No, I would say sometimes I used to do like a separate documentary list and regular movies. I'm just kind of combining them for the for the sake of this. But yeah,
aside awesome. Of that. All right. So I'll start off with my number 10 pick here. And this is one that I'm a sucker for, because I'm a sucker for most films of this genre. Science fiction just always appeals to me in some way, shape, or form. We got a handful of decent science fiction films this year. I know some people, this is a little polarizing, or you know, some people were definitely opposed to it, but I was not one of those people. I have Ad Astra at my number 10 with Brad Pitt. Good year for Brad Pitt in general. For those that don't think he's a good actor or a movie star, I think this year would show you the opposite. And I like the variety of films that he does. But Ad Astra just appealed to me in a lot of different ways. I mean, it kept things close enough to the vest where I couldn't necessarily predict all the different ways that it was going to go. I thought it gave you some good things to think about, some real good acting, a lot of stuff towards the end that was what I kind of like in a science fiction film, you know, thought provoking ideas or moments. And I just really enjoyed Ad Astra. I haven't had a chance to go back and see it again, and that's why it's kind of just hovering right here at the edge of the countdown, because I'd like to see it again to really cement where it should fall. But on first view, I really enjoyed Ad Astra.
That's one I did catch up. It's actually my number 15 for me for the year as we stand right now. The ending didn't completely work for me, but I thought there were some sequences in that which were just incredible. The opening, for example, was one of the best scenes of the year, and then the moon chase, which was fantastic. But this in general is also, like you mentioned, very thought-provoking. I know, if I remember correctly, you were not a huge fan of The Lost City of Z, if I'm not wrong. So I'm surprised that you I'm glad that it seems like at least James Gray is working for you when it comes to a space adventure.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. And you mentioned the moon chase like that. I think that's the closest we've gotten to revisiting Mad Max. Like, since that came out, I felt like I was going back to that like type of just epic from a visual standpoint, and just kind of the drama involved in that. And it was weird, too, because it was doing it in a way that was like, it wasn't all right up in your face for a lot of it. You were almost like disconnected or seeing it from a distance, but you still felt that tension and that drama in that sequence. So yeah, Lost City of Z did not work for me. Ad Astra did. So I will continue to give James Gray chances as we move forward. So how about you? What's your number 10?
My number 10 is From the World of Documentary. It's a documentary I don't see a lot of people talking about. I don't know. It's maybe because people haven't watched it or what the case is, but it's actually now streaming on Netflix. So if you're interested in it, it's Tell Me Who I Am, directed by Ed Perkins. And it's a story of, it's almost like it has a soap opera plot in a way. It's a story of these two identical twins. And one of the identical twins, when he was 18, got in a car accident, a motorcycle accident, had brain damage, and pretty much forgot every single thing about his life, except the fact that he has a twin, and he knew his brother, and that's all he knew. Like, he saw his mom, didn't recognize her, didn't remember anything from their childhood. All he knew, only fact he had, was he knew and trusted his brother. And it was off based upon that trust where he basically reshaped his life. His brother helped, you know, to allow him to remember, or, you know, inform him about the life that they had. But what you come to realize, it's right in the opening of the movie, is that his brother left a lot of things out, a lot of horrible things that I'll leave vague, because as it unveils, you kind of see, you know, that dilemma he was under, and in the sense of he wanted to protect his brother. It's like he had the opportunity basically to give him a life he never had, which is, you know, it's this fascinating dilemma of being in that situation is what do you do? Do you confront the truth or allow him to live this lie and you know, have more of a joyous life? But also on the flip side, what do you do when your entire life, everything that you know and love is built on this one truth, and then that truth is taken away and you realize that truth is faulty? So you, in a way, have nothing. And you see that confrontation kind of play out on screen. And it's just well shot. It's well directed. There's some not mockumentary style, but they, you know, they play out some scenes. It's very much a talking head documentary in a way, but some archival footage, mostly just using photographs and things of that nature. But I thought it was just well shot, great score as well, and just really emotionally packed. I also like the dilemma it presented. It was also one of those things where I just kind of threw it on and didn't have much expectations for it. And I just kind of popped up as my, you might enjoy. And sometimes Netflix is right. And in this case, it definitely was. So, and then my number 10 is Tell Me Who I Am.
Nice. That does sound interesting. I'll have to check that one out. We're always looking for something on Netflix that's interesting. So for sure, add that to the queue. For my number 9, that one of the themes, I guess, a mini theme, I guess, in 2019 that I noticed for some films is we got a lot of films from or surrounding around the idea of people that were trying to make a career out of singing. Especially from the female perspective, we got a bunch of films that are all in my top 50 that had to deal with individual females that were trying to get noticed or like I said, make a career in the singing world. We got stuff like Teen Spirit, which was more about kind of reality contests that this girl was trying to enter, called Teen Spirit, and trying to make it. And we had the more kind of gritty Her Smell, that was definitely dealing with somebody that had already made it, but kind of all the different demons and different things that she was dealing with. But the one that kind of worked for me even more than those two was a film called Wild Rose. And this is about a young Scottish singer who dreams of making it as a country artist in Nashville after being released from prison, directed by Tom Harper. And this one for me, I don't know if it was the performance by Jesse Buckley or if it was just the fact that, unlike the other two, this one seemed more real to me, like somebody more relatable, someone that seemed more real world. It's not just somebody that kind of got a break on a reality show or something like this. I mean, this individual was released from prison. She has children. She is not always the greatest role model of the best mom. She's not going to win like Mom of the Year award because she's putting her desire to be this, you know, famous country singer way ahead of any responsibility she has to her family, especially her kids. But it's got a lot of drama involved in it, but it just also felt real. And like I said, the performances really drew me in. And out of the three that were kind of that same type of film, this one definitely hit the hardest for me. So I definitely enjoyed seeing the journey that she was on and kind of seeing the things that it took for her to realize her role and her relationship to singing and her relationship to her family. I guess I'll say, because I don't want to necessarily spoil anything, but Wild Rose really worked for me. I know a lot of people also enjoyed it. I mean, it didn't get a lot of buzz, but I haven't heard much negative about it. So that is my number 9.
That's one actually I was trying to cram in before we did this episode. I watched like the first, speaking of seeing movies on the portion, like the first like 20 or so minutes, and I really enjoyed what I saw, but I wasn't able to finish it in time, excellent, unfortunately. But yeah, like you said, even the leading performance was already, you know, very evident of its strength right from the beginning. So
yeah, for sure. And it sucked me in immediately.
And I'm not a huge country song fan, but I'm like, I'm actually enjoying it. So that's a good song. No, good time.
What do you got for number 9?
So for my number 10 was a small documentary that, you know, it's not huge acclaim. My number 9 was the biggest movie of the year, or it is the biggest movie of the year, and it's Avengers Endgame. I am a Marvel fan. I enjoy most of their, if not all, the MCU movies to some extent. And this was my most anticipated movie of the year, because this, you know, it was building for a decade. I know there's a lot of negatives you can say regarding what the MCU has done, the film in general, and like the studio aspect of it and whatnot. And I get that. And I think those are legitimate complaints. But I also think there is something achievement within that as well. And because, you know, we've seen other people try and fail, and you know, to be able to be this successful continuously is an achievement of itself, and making movies that I think are this good. And, you know, that, I don't say that they transcend the genre. They more so define the genre of comic book movies and the spectacle in that fashion, with great performances from great actors. And it's crazy when you look back of what they started off as, this little Iron Man movie, and now what it's come to with this gigantic, huge battle between all these different parties. But also what I loved about Endgame was how the first hour or so was just kind of reconciling with the previous movie. And a lot of people were thinking like the snap is not going to mean anything. It's just going to, you know, they're all going to come back. But there was some stakes there that I thought I was not expecting. And I thought it, you know, it stayed small before it got into the huge gigantic battle at the end. And, but you know, it had plenty of moments to stand up and cheer. I know the theater I was in, I went nearly opening night, and the on your left moment, like the crowd was cheering, like roaring. Those are the type of moments that you kind of live for when it comes to film, in a way. You know, like having those thought-provoking films are obviously great, but having that too, I think it has its place. And certainly Avengers Endgame has its place. I think the only downside is like, I feel like, I don't know. Like I'm good. Like if MCU was done today, I think I'd be fine. Cause I feel like it told this, you know, huge long story. Now it feels over. It's continuing. I'm curious how that's going to go. Cause it's going to be hard to kind of keep it moving. But for now, I'm just going to enjoy Endgame.
I definitely enjoyed it as well. It's sitting in my like 20 to 25 range. And I think two things that have been impressive about the whole run with the MCU, regardless of what your opinions are of the MCU, whether you're a fan or not, or think it's harmful or not, whatever, put that all aside. Two times now, they have had a monumental task. Like, we're talking about like trying to write the finale of Lost or trying to write the finale of Game of Thrones. Like they had the first time that we got the Avengers film when it was going to be the first team up, and you're like, are they honestly going to be able to juggle all these characters? We've seen attempts like this to put this many characters in a comic book film fail time and time again, and they pulled that one off. And now we get like the conclusion of however many films it had been at that point. What was it, like 16 or something like that? I don't remember. But like all these films, and it's like there's no right way to do this. Like you're never going to be able to pull this off. And again, they pulled it off. So I think that's impressive. I do feel the same as you though. Like I never, like people talk about superhero film or Marvel film fatigue or different things like that, and I was always like, that might be a thing for some people, but so far every film I've watched I've enjoyed and to different levels, and it's never left me not wanting to see more. And then all of a sudden this one happened, and afterwards I was like, wait a second, like I might be good. Like maybe maybe that is enough. Like I never saw it coming, but after watching that I was like, that would be a decent time to stop. And my interest is a little plateaued then for stuff that's coming after. I'm not saying I'm not going to watch it. We're big comic book movie fans of any kind, or you know, just anything like that, so we will be watching them. But it's just a weird feeling afterwards that I was like, I don't know if I'm going to have the same excitement now ever again.
It's like you know, running a marathon and then like, all right, that's over, now let's get in line for the next one. And it's like, oh, geez. All that training and everything like that, I don't know if I want to jump back in and
need some donuts for a while first.
Like I'm seeing the trailers for Black Widow, I'm like, that looks fine. Like I'm just, I don't know. Like, yeah, like the excitement for that story. And like Internals, which is, I hopefully, and we'll get more into that, but yeah, for now, I'm just going to like, at least at this, you know, this portion of it, it ended on top, and then we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, absolutely. For my number eight, not as big of a film as far as what you're hearing being talked about when it comes to all the different Oscars and maybe a bunch of top lists, but definitely worked for me. Also a rare film that has co-directing credits, which usually is not a good sign. Directed by Tyler Nelson and Michael Schwartz. And also it has Shia LaBeouf in it, which sometimes can be dangerous. And I'm not necessarily, I've never been like a huge Dakota Johnson fan, but that just means, that's just because I haven't seen a lot of her films. But the Peanut Butter Falcon from this last year hit me out of nowhere. This might've been one of my biggest surprises of the year, because I just kind of like randomly put it on because I'm like, well, I remember seeing the trailer and it looked like it might be a decent film, and put it on and it blew me away. I don't know if it was just, I do like professional wrestling, and there is a professional wrestling slant towards it. There's some, you know, the main character there is a young man who his dream is to be a professional wrestler. And it does have some interesting guest appearances or cameos that wrestling fans would appreciate. So, but I think it was more just the, again, the realness of this film. Like, it felt real. The relationships between all of the different characters, the interactions, the discussions, and it's just one of those where you have somebody that is does have obstacles in their life that are, you know, standing between them and their dreams, but sometimes it's those types of situations that help other folks around them come to a realization themselves of what's important in life, what's important in interactions with other people, and in relationships, and kind of bringing out the good in people. And I think Shia LaBeouf is amazing in this, you know, regardless of what your opinion is of him and whether he's crazy or not, he can put a very good acting performance together. And he definitely did that in The Peanut Butter Falcon. So this was one of my favorite films of the year. It's funny. It's got a little bit of drama in it and it's got some wrestling in it. So that's cool. So that's my number 8.
This is actually standing for me at 14, and it's just such a charming little movie. It's just, yeah, you know, it's very wholesome and pleasant in that way. Like, it's, you know, it obviously has its dramatic aspects, but it's just, you know, seeing this unlikely friendship. And I think Shia LaBeouf is a legit actor. I think he's proven, yeah, that. He certainly, as like even Honey Boy shows, which I don't know, maybe it'll be a movie we talk about. You know, he has his demons, but I think he can put on a good performance, and I think that shows within this as well. And I think the one thing that kind of stopped it from making my top 10 was that there were some little bit of plot contrivances, right, that happened here and there. But overall, I think, you know, that wasn't really the point of the movie. Right. You know, ultimately, it was just kind of just displaying this friendship and finding, like you said, like joy in the unlikely situation. Which, and it's got a great setting too.
Just, I think those actors involved just were really able to pull off performances that made you believe their interactions and their relationships, right, with each other.
Yeah, definitely. So it was really, really well casted. Plus, anytime you know, you have Mick Foley making a cameo in Jake the Snake Roberts, yeah, probably the best movie Mick Foley's ever been in. I think I can. Well, maybe Beyond the Mat, beyond that, but I don't know. So I feel like as I'm looking at my top 10, I feel like I'm going from like big, small, big, small, big, small. We'll see. But because my number 8 is another really, you know, small movie per se, The Farewell, directed by Lulu Wang. And Awkwafina is someone like I have not had a lot of exposure to. I've seen some of her comedy stuff, and she was in Crazy Rich Asians. I thought she was funny. I'm like, oh, she seems like, you know, she'll be kind of in that role. And then I saw her in this. I'm like, wow, she is a legit great actress. And I was really kind of blown away by that. And this film in general, for those that don't know, The Farewell, it tells the story of a situation where Awkwafina plays this character. She has to travel to China because her grandmother is dying of cancer. But the thing is, they're not telling her she's dying of cancer because they don't want her to, they want her last days to be more joyous. And they're basically pretending they're going there for a wedding. So it's this struggle of, you know, growing up being more the American culture and wanting to tell her against, you know, the culture there and seeing that clash. The movie, I felt like it reminded me the most of kind of going through this, and maybe it's a little too obvious, would be like The Big Sick. And the reason being with that, because it presented something I think, you know, many of us Westerners would think, well, no, that's definitely wrong. Like in The Big Sick, it was arranged marriage, and this was like how we deal with death. But I think then through the experience of the film, you see, you know, the more reasoning of it, being able to live that life and seeing, you know, there's some benefit there. It was also just, again, powered by great performances. The actress that played the grandmother was fantastic as well. And it just, there's this family unity that's displayed. Lulu Wang, she did a lot of, the way she utilized the camera with a lot of group shots of the family, especially near the end. Like, you just, this unification of the family that comes together and has its struggles. And it's comedic, it's touching, it's moving. The very end of it, it's very moving. This long tracking shot is the kind of realization it washes through these characters. I was very impressed with it all throughout. And I love movies that kind of give you an ability to kind of see life that you're not, nor know nothing of, or a way of life you know nothing of. And that certainly was the case here, and present an idea that may challenge what you typically think. So, and it all that kind of made it to me one of my favorite films of the year. So my number 8, The Farewell.
Well, I'll have to add that one to the list. I've heard about it a little bit, and I've heard good things about it.
It is streaming currently on Prime, so if you have that.
Okay, perfect. I'll add that to the Prime queue, because that definitely intrigued me based on your description there, so I will check that one out. For my number 7, if I can continue to do the numbers correctly, I'll go to what I consider probably the funniest film for me for the year. And I was a complete... I have a complete blind spot for this director, I believe. I don't know if I've seen any other of his films or not. Maybe one, but I don't think I have. I'm talking about Jim Jarmusch and The Dead Don't Die from this last year, the greatest zombie cast ever disassembled. But Adam Driver, Bill Murray, Tilda Swinton, I can't say Chloe's last name, so I won't. And a lot of other people obviously involved in this one. But I was not prepared for this one for me to find it as funny as I did. And I know some people won't. It does have some political commentary or social commentary, I guess, and some people do shy away from that. But I thought it was a perfect blend of just, maybe it's just the humor that he puts in this movie is just more my style of humor. I like the kind of dry Bill Murray style of humor. And I'm not a big zombie film fan. Like, I don't typically get drawn into a lot of the more zombie-like or supernatural films, but for this one it just worked. And just some great performances, especially Bill Murray. Tilda Swinton has some great moments in this as well. And you can tell right from the beginning whether you're going to find this film funny, because they are driving down the road, like in the first scene, and they literally are commenting on the theme song that's playing. So like, if you enjoy that scene, you're going to be enjoying, you know, the rest of the runtime, I would think. But there's just a lot to love and a lot of different little pokes at different things throughout our society and commentary on it that I thought was fitting. But even without that, I still think it's a funny enough film to just kind of sit back and have some fun, and probably a good one to watch with a group, I would think. Even though I didn't do that, I would think it would be even better with a group of people. But The Dead Don't Die, to me, was the best comedy of the year. So that is my number 7.
I have yet to see it. Jim Jarmusch is usually hit or miss for me. I love him in some stuff. I don't. I did a plan on it, but honestly, it's a movie that I remember hearing a lot about when it was coming out, but then honestly, it just dropped off the map for me. So now you reminded me that I need to see it. So
I'd be interested to see your take on it, because like I said, I don't think it's for everybody, but I think you would enjoy it. And I don't know. Like, for me, I just said the style of humor makes me want to seek more Jim Jarmusch out to see if I did, but maybe it'll be hit or miss, like you said.
Yeah. So my number 7 is, as I mentioned, I went to the Best Picture Showcase. This was the last movie that we saw within that. And I think it's probably because it was, I think, originally the favorite to win Best Picture, but ultimately did not win Best Picture. And that's 1917. And it was probably the movie I was most looking forward to, just because the first trailer for this was amazing. I'm like, it really sold the film. And I know 1917, the first thing people talk about is the quote-unquote gimmick of the extended long take. And I also feel like people use the word gimmick as if it's like someone putting on a nice shiny jacket. It's like, it's also an extremely difficult thing to do that requires a lot of effort and talent in order to achieve it. So I'm like, yeah, I guess that's a gimmick, but I don't know. I mean, did it need it? And I don't necessarily know. I was amazed by it. I thought it was one of the best looking movies of the year, just on the sets alone. Like I never wanted to see the making of a movie more as I was watching a movie than watching this, which some people may argue takes you out of it. But I necessarily didn't for me, because I was looking at these sets and I'm like, this is incredible. Like the extended nature of them, like this, it felt like you were there in that way. It almost felt like a post-apocalyptic movie, because it just, this desolate wasteland, you know, that is no man's land. And it felt like we don't see a lot of World War One movies. I think it's because of thinking, as you see with this, it's just a difficult landscape to maneuver. And I think really kind of get that, you know, it's a horrible thing to watch, you know, trench warfare. And I thought this was pulse pounding. It was ultimately, when I first walked out of it, to me, it's like, this is my favorite movie of the year. It dropped down a little bit just because I do wonder if, like, without that edgier seat excitement that a lot of it is bent on, would it work as much as a rewatch? I'm not sure, but still, I just found it like remarkably made. Roger Deakins is a god when it comes to filmmaking, and also the performances, I think, are kind of getting left out. Yeah. And because of, you know, everything else that people are talking about. But, you know, George MacKay, who plays, quote unquote, one of the main characters, like what he had to go through to get a lot of this done, and as well as the other actors, I think it's, I don't know. I just was amazed by it. And I think it saddens me, like a lot of it just kind of gets centered on this one aspect of it. And I could see why people would not love it. I have people saying it feels like a video game, and I can kind of see that, but I think we're in a time and place where being like a video game isn't necessarily a negative thing. And in a way, it felt like a video game because I felt like I was experiencing it along with the characters, which I feel like is a plus for me. Right. So that's why it's my number 7.
I'll jump off this a little bit too, because it's my number 6. And I saw this with a friend who is not necessarily a cinephile. Like he doesn't dissect movies, he doesn't review movies or anything like this. And we were sitting in it, and I remember because he leaned over, like, I don't know, 10 minutes in or something like that. And he's like, this has all been one take. It's like, this is amazing. I'm like, I can't even believe you picked up on that. But it does immerse you into the film. I didn't feel like it was video gamey to me. I mean, I guess if video game means that you felt like you were a part of it, maybe, but I never felt like I was watching something that was fake. Like, I was impressed with the techniques and stuff like that. But I think what works more for me in this movie is, like what you're talking about, is the relationship, especially between the two leads. And I am surprised that kind of has kind of been wiped away a little bit, because that's what really sells this movie, is their bond, their relationship, the things that they're doing together and for each other. And might have one of the biggest jump scares of the entire year for me. I literally jumped out of my seat at one point in this film, which is typical for me. I get scared easy in films. But the landscape and the way that they do kind of capture some of that World War One stuff. We see a lot of World War II stuff, you know what I mean? We used to see a lot of Civil War type films, and we don't get a lot of World War One. It is a tough war to film, I think, in a lot of ways, and I think they do a fantastic job. It seems like it's been years since we had a real, real good war film. Maybe I'm just blanking on some stuff, but this was a, I don't want to say pleasant surprise, because it wasn't nothing about this movie that's pleasant necessarily, but yeah. I mean, it is a war film, but it had me captivated throughout the whole thing. And I was definitely understanding the buzz, because I did see this late in the game after, you know, it had already won quite a few awards and was favorites for others. So the expectations were high, and I did not feel let down or disappointed in any way. That's why it's obviously in my top 10, but I think it's a real great film that, can be beneficial for a lot of people to see, and especially from a historical standpoint. You know, if anyone's trying to kind of tell a story of what World War One was like and what trench warfare is like, they could point to scenes in this film to kind of illustrate that. So definitely agree with you there, as it is my number 6 as well.
Nice, very nice. My number 6 is a movie that I talked about, Rewatchability. It's a movie I never want to see again, to be honest with you, just because it is a brutal movie to watch and experience. And it's The Nightingale, directed by Jennifer Kent, who I think the first thing that really, you know, kind of put her on the scene was The Babadook, which is a movie I really did enjoy as well. Well, again, enjoy is the wrong word. It's certainly it was a well-made movie. And same thing with with The Nightingale. And it is, wow, it's an experience. I say I never want to watch it again because there's so much of this movie that is etched in my brain that I'm never going to forget. And I think I would qualify this as a horror film because I was legitimately horrified throughout, a revenge thriller. And sometimes those can be played out in the sense of just, you know, seeing horrible things happen and then seeing the result of that. But to me, that there's a lot more here, especially dealing with this. This is a story of taking place in the 1800s in Tasmania, which is it almost takes a little bit to even kind of realize your time and place because it is such a unique place in the world. And it does feel like you're in another world in a way. And you're with these British colonists and you have this Claire, who is this 21-year-old convict who's kind of stuck there, and she wants to leave, but she's not allowed. She's basically an indentured servant, and as she's in her attempt to kind of become free, her captors do horrible things to her and her family, and then she tries to enact revenge in a way throughout it with the help of an Aborigine Native guide, as she doesn't know the land. It's one of those places where you can easily get lost, and it's a story that it kind of, you see that revenge, and it's revenge that takes its toll, and it makes you really think about all these different things that happen. I could see a lot of people watching the first 45 minutes or so and like turning it off and never wanting watching it, like, because there's some bad things that do happen, but I think what it has to say, it makes that journey worth it. And the way it's handled, and then the performances alone, probably my favorite female performance of the year. And similar when the Babadook, that had my favorite female performance of that year as well. So Jennifer Kent's a really great, I think, director at kind of getting those types of performances out of her actors. And it was funny because I watched this, and then a few weeks after that, I was home for the holidays, and my sister-in-law was like, "Oh, this book's great. You should really read it. It's really enjoyable." She gave it's an amazing book. So she gave it to me to read, and it was A Nightingale. I'm like, I'm not reading that. I watched the movie. I never do not want to experience that again, because it's like, I cannot imagine reading that. I'm like, I'm good. I am not going to go through that. I'm sure the book's better. Maybe. I don't know. I didn't honestly even know it was a book, but I was like, oh no. So I know I'm probably not selling it in the best way, but like I said, it's an experience. It was a remarkably made movie that I will never forget. So that's why it made my number six.
I mentioned that it was the year of films that I got to start and not finish, and this is one of the culprits as well. For those of you that don't know him, other co-host Amanda, Hard Candy Mandy, my wife is pregnant, and we were looking for something to watch one night while we were lying in bed, and turned that on. And
not the best choice.
No. Did not go over well. And then, there's something that happens in the beginning, and I'm like, well, that's, just setting up the story for the rest of the way. It'll be fine. Let's keep watching. And then other things happen. She's giving me a look, and I said, okay, I think we're done. We're good with that one. I do plan on eventually watching the rest of it because I'm curious to see how it all goes. And it did have some, intriguing things to look for. And I think I need to see the resolution at least to hopefully appease some things in my head, but maybe it doesn't happen. I don't know.
But, it's not like, the Punisher where it's like you feel, where you feel like, oh, you're cheering at the end or whatever. But it's certainly, I think.
Some type of catharsis or something, hopefully.
Yeah, exactly.
But I can definitely see a lot of people, like you said, not getting through it as we didn't. But it definitely is something that doesn't seem like a movie that you'd forget. I definitely can't forget the first 40 minutes, so. I'm sure. And there's a couple other films like that this year that I'm like, well, I'm never going to forget what I just saw. It's on my list of things to eventually finish. For my number five, I was worried about this one. I was worried because, we got the documentary last year, which I wasn't as big of a fan of as some other people. I mean, I still think it was good, but I wasn't as sold. And then I'm like, okay, now we're going to get a movie based on that documentary. Am I going to be equally disappointed in that? And I definitely was not. Tom Hanks as Mr. Rogers in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood was great for me. Mariel Heller directed this one, and I thought it was an interesting take. You know, this isn't necessarily a focus on Fred Rogers as much as it is the journalist that is doing a piece on him, Lloyd Vogel. And I think that was a great way to frame this film. And I think the performances are incredible. It's funny because we're watching the opening where they go through the whole thing that we've seen a thousand times, you know, people from our generation, at least, where Fred Rogers, you know, comes into the set and, you know, changes, you know, shoes and clothes and or jackets and whatever. And it was funny because Amanda was watching it with me and she's like, oh, he messed up. He didn't do the thing. And then like, he immediately did the thing that she was waiting for him to do from the actual show that we saw a thousand times. I was like, oh my God, the attention to detail that they had on this was amazing. I enjoyed the artistic decisions that they had to kind of show the city overall, or different things like they did, like, you know, taken from the original show where they would show all the like miniaturized houses and things like that to kind of give the landscape. They did that a lot in this film to kind of do scene changes and things of that nature, which I thought was cool. But I think the same thing that you could say that a lot of people were saying about the documentary, like, it's just a good positive refreshing thing to watch in today's day and age with everything else that's going on in society and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, everyone's looking for that, like, that story that's going to be revealed in one of these movies or documentaries about how Fred Rogers was, you know, really not that great a guy, or, you know, let's, you know, tarnish him like so many of our other people that we looked up to, or that, you know, we watched growing up have had happen. And it's just like, it's not going to happen, guys. Like, everybody has things that they struggle with, and they do point to some of that stuff, but it's not going to be the, you know, there's no, you know, smoking gun. There's no, you know, like, National Enquirer type headline that you're going to get out of this. You know, he meant well, he did well, and he meant a lot to a lot of people. And I think this film does an amazing job of kind of encapsulating the phenomenon of Fred Rogers and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. So this was something that resonated well with me as being a fan of the show, and something that I thought was a great change of pace. So Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood is my number five.
Nice. That's one I have yet to see, so I can't really comment on it. I'm looking for, unlike you, I did really document my top 10 last year. So I'm interested to seeing how that stacks up. Cause I know it's a different story. It's more about the interviewer and his relationship with him, but we'll see.
I think it does a nice job of like I said, I think it helps make the, I don't know, it helps make the story something that you haven't seen before, I guess, in a way. Mm-hmm. So,
nice. Yeah.
What's your number?
It's Tom Hanks playing Mr. Rogers. You can't get more wholesome than that. So.
Not at all.
My number five, you know, number six, my Nightingale is very, you know, depressing and movie that would take its toll. My number five is more, I think, uplifting and kind of gives you hope for humanity, because it centers on one of the greatest achievements of all mankind. It's the documentary Apollo 11. It's, you know, using all archival footage of the actual moon landing and everything leading up to it. It's, I'm a sucker for those type of documentaries that are just telling a story using the footage of the day, from Senna, Let the Fire Burn, to my favorite movies of the decade. And now Apollo 11 is up there as well. And, you know, it's, you think about it, like, imagining being able to go back to the Columbus landing, you know, in the New World, and seeing what that was like, being able to live through that and see everything that lived up to that moment. Now we now live in the time and place where that's possible. And we can go back and see basically all the effort and achievement that went into this movie. It's also just an experience itself. It's like, even though you know what's happening, even though you know the inevitability of them landing on the moon, it's something, you know, as you're seeing that approach, still like heart pounding. It's, you know, again, partially due to a fantastic score and just this, the amazing footage that they had and how it was cut together. I think it was a travesty this was not nominated for best documentary, because to me, it's my favorite documentary of the year by far. And I think one of the best documentaries of the decade, and perhaps it didn't get the acclaim because it's, you know, it's not new footage or what have you. I'm not sure, but I still think it's it tells an incredible story, and it just like, oh yeah, we can achieve amazing things. And and being a, you know, First Man was one of my favorite films of last year, so it makes sense that this would also, you know, fall in line with that as well. So, and this is again streaming on, I believe it's streaming on Hulu, so if you want to check it out, it's readily available.
And I'm hoping that, because I've been getting a little bit more into documentaries in the last year or two, and I'd love to see like a best of decade list from you for documentaries in some way, shape, or form, because it would give me some stuff to jump off from.
Actually, I have one on Letterboxd, and perhaps I'll do one on the site that I'm working on, because yeah, it was a lot of great ones.
Yeah, for sure. For my, I mean, I'm going to be boring from the rest of the way out, guys, just so you know. There's not going to be any like crazy picks that you haven't heard of, or, you know, something that you wouldn't expect. So apologize for that in advance. But for my number four, it's the best picture winner. It's Bong Joon-ho's Parasite. I just saw this actually the day before the Oscars. Saturday, we had like the Saturday before the Oscars, we had a couple people over, one of our friend's birthdays, and he brought over the Blu-ray of Parasite. He saw this very early on. It's a friend that usually goes to most of the movies with Amanda and I, and he had seen this on his own like way back, I want to say in the middle of summer or whenever it came out or something. And he mentioned it right away. He's like, you guys got to see this film. This is like one of my favorite films of the year so far. And it took us until the day before the Oscars to finally get it, because we were waiting for the ability to have the, you know, obviously have the subtitles and whatnot. And so we brought it over and we watched it in our new theater room, and it did not disappoint. Definitely. And we're not people that are opposed to, we watch all of our movies with subtitles on. So the fact that we had to watch subtitles had no effect whatsoever on us, because I know a couple, you know, Neanderthals out there probably are bothered by that. But but this movie just had all kinds of interesting twists and turns, and the drama, it's not something that you'd necessarily think of as a thriller to me, but it is thrilling because there is a lot of stuff that you're wondering how it's going to turn out, wondering, you know, if the other shoe is going to drop type stuff. And the performances are fantastic. Obviously, I was a fan of Snowpiercer as well. I don't know if I've seen all of his other films, but I definitely enjoyed Snowpiercer, and this one's probably even better than that one. So I thought it was a fantastic film. I thought there was a little bit more ambiguity in the ending than some people do, maybe. But I did definitely enjoy this film all the way through. I can't talk too much about it because I don't want to spoil anything. I know a lot of people have already seen it, but just in case you haven't, I think you should go seek out Parasite. Don't worry about the subtitles. It's great. And that's my number four.
Yes. I will just say that's a good pick. And
all right, what's your number four, Dan?
My number four is also also another film that was nominated for Best Picture. And you know, when coming up with these lists, it's like the difference between best and favorite. And I think it's probably much for me more favorite than this. But expectations, I think, play a huge role in how much, you know, movies hit you and how much you enjoy them. You know, when I look at something like Avengers Endgame, that movie I had a lot of expectations for it. I kind of knew what it was going into. My number four is a movie I probably wouldn't have seen for this list, or probably maybe eventually got to, but because it was part of the Best Picture Showcase, I ended up seeing it, and I was quite amazed by it, and that's Little Women, directed by Greta Gerwig. I like Lady Bird. I wasn't as huge a fan as many had that it was good, but it didn't kind of transcend, or, you know, it didn't have the impact on me it seemed to have on a lot of people. But going into Little Women, like, I know the story well enough. I've watched the Friends episode when they talk about Little Women, and I never watched the 90s movie, but I was just like, I don't know. We'll see how it goes. And I think what Little Women did, amongst many things, which being a comic book fan, I wish comic book movies, and which I don't think I've seen a comic book movie do this, is make me, as someone that's an outsider looking in, understand why people appreciate the source material as much, and the importance of that material is the people within the film itself, without making it obvious. It's like, oh, I understand why the story resonates with people in a way, and what it's saying. And why it's so important that it's being told again. You know, I heard a lot of people were before it came out, myself included, probably was like, do we really need another Little Woman movie? And I think, yeah, this is to me showing that, yeah, I mean, ultimately you can still get something great of it. And, you know, and how, you know, Greta Gerwig structured it and flipping timelines. But outside of that, bringing in, I think, other elements from the authors outside of just the normal book. I've never read the book, but just doing some research on it and hearing that she kind of took other works and took other speeches and added them into this. The performances are all really strong as well. And it's just a fantastic screenplay that made me go through and like, oh, this, I completely, you know, went in with eyes open. In understanding, like, okay, this story, you know, it's not just this quaint little story about people, you know, living in suburbia during, you know, during the 1800s. It has an importance to it about the importance of women's stories in general and what they mean, and why a story like this needs to be told, and why from then when it first came out to today. So that's really what really struck with me with it. So it's made it my number four. Like, I never expected it to be one of my favorite movies of the year, but I'm like, wow, it was. And I was, and I'm, you know, Greta Gerwig, as you know, is not someone is, I think, shown as she's just, you know, I've always thought she's been a great actress, but as a filmmaker, she's got a voice that is so well defined already in only a few films. And I really look forward to see what she does next. And oh, Saoirse Ronan too is just, as an actress, is freaking phenomenal. And I think I don't know why more people weren't pushing her for Oscars. Like, I know she got nominated, but I can't say it. I didn't see the movie, you know, Renee Zellweger's, you know, Oscar winning performance. But I feel like she's been such a great actress already. It's kind of, I feel like she should have gotten more recognition than she did, because she was great in this. Yeah, that was my number four.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of hers, and I think the cast overall is just something to look out for. So I definitely have this on my list of things to see. It was just like the one Best Picture nominee that we did not have a chance to get to. We've tried multiple times on to different ways to watch it and just haven't found one that will work for us so far. But I'm definitely looking forward to checking that out. We're big Saoirse Ronan fans, and I think Greta Gerwig is definitely cementing or carving out a spot in the world of cinema that is needed and worthy. So we're looking forward to that one. But I was definitely just like you going into the year, like, it was not on my most anticipated film list or anything like that. I'm like, really? I think there's enough of this out there. But definitely based on word of mouth and what I heard and what you said, definitely on the list of things to see. Talking about films that were on my most anticipated list, my number three, I think, was on my most anticipated list at least two, if not 3 years in a row. And it was very high on that list, and it finally came out. It finally happened. And because of the long wait, they gave us a long film. I'm talking about The Irishman at number three from Martin Scorsese. I mean, how can you not enjoy De Niro, Pesci, and Pacino and Scorsese coming together again? I don't care how long it is. We watched it in one sitting. It was fine. I never got tired of what I was watching. I never needed a break. If you do, you can watch it in installments. I'm pretty sure there's a website that gives you like chapters to watch, so you can watch it in pieces, and it gives you when to stop it and all that kind of stuff if you're interested. But I don't know. I just really enjoyed this film. It, one thing that always kind of ranks a film a little bit higher for me is a film that will make me talking about films that are like at all based on anything or have anything to do with real events, real people, or anything like that, even if it's loosely. If a film can make me so interested in that topic or in that subject that afterwards I'm immediately like researching it, I think the film has done its job. And it's just such an intriguing story with what happened to Hoffa and all the different, like the number of people that have confessed to his murder is ridiculous. Like half a dozen people, I think, at least have claimed to have had something to do with his death. And, you know, do we believe this one or not? It doesn't really matter, because it's a film and you can enjoy it whether it's true or not. But it's just such an intriguing story. And I wasn't bothered by any of the de-aging process. I know some people were, but I thought it was fine. And I just like gangster movies. I needed this. I'm a huge Goodfellas fan and Casino and Godfather. And to me, this was something that we may, you know, we probably never get anything like this again, maybe, I would think, at least not with this group. So I enjoyed it. I think it was worth the wait of having it number one on my most anticipated list. I'm pretty sure like 2 or 3 years in a row. So I'm glad we finally got it. And I was a big fan of The Irishman, obviously, since it's my number three.
Yeah, it's in my 11 through 20. I did also really enjoy it. And Joe Pesci, man, like that, like that, to me, he makes the movie. I mean, obviously, Robert De Niro, it's great seeing him like act great again. Uh-huh. You know, he's not chosen the best project.
Right.
He's had some good here and there. Like he was really good in, you know, working with David O. Russell and things like that. But This is him at his best. Some of the aging stuff, it didn't take me out of it. I think you kind of settle into it per se. Right. And definitely is a different. I know some people maybe went into it thinking this is going to be Goodfellas, but it's not Goodfellas. It's much more cerebral in that sense. So, but yeah. I was one of those movies I was thinking we were never going to see because felt like it was never coming out, but it finally did. My number three is talking about expectations. You remember you mentioned throwing on Peanut Butter Falcon and not really having any expectations for it. Similar happened to me with my number three, and then that's why I talk about when favorite versus best. We're like, I don't know, filmmaking wise, if this would stack up to something like 1917, but when it comes to like hitting my sensibilities and what I tend to enjoy for films, this really hit it really strong. And it's The Mustang, directed by first time director, or first feature, I should say, Laurie de Clermont Torin. I'm probably butchered that, but she's actually, I believe, French. This was based, she did a short film called The Rabbit that expanded into this movie called The Mustang. And actually, it was helped produced by Sundance, and Robert Redford played a huge part in getting this movie made. And it's about this story. It takes place in Nevada in a prison there. It's about this program that's been established where there's about 100,000 Mustangs throughout in the wild, and because of, you know, farming and overpopulation, each year they bring in a bunch of them and capture and then bring them to jails to kind of tame them. And there's this therapy program where people that are in jail kind of work with these animals to try to, you know, do both, you know, you what'll happen is they'll get them tamed and sell them, but also as part of their, you know, rehabilitation as prisoners as well. And this kind of centers on that. It stars Mathesis, I'm gonna pronounce his name, Skonosis. I'm not even close. I'm not even gonna but he's been in a bunch of stuff. He was in Rust and Bone, was one of his biggest movies. He was in the Drop. He played a small role in that. Bullhead. I believe he is he's from Belgium. Great his performance. This is minus my favorite film of the year. This is probably my second favorite male performance. And he plays this convict who's in jail. It's very quiet but violent performance. And I think what really struck about me with this movie is a number of different things. A lot of times when you see movies that take place in jail or prison films, it's about either you have them about the escape, or it centers on a character that's a prisoner for the harder goal, the prisoner that didn't belong there, the prisoner that, you know, maybe they did a bad thing, but ultimately they're a good person, or maybe they are innocent and they're being framed or what have you. This isn't the case here. This is a man who belongs in jail. You know, he is, you know, he has a violent streak to him, and he did something wrong that he admits to, and because of that, he's in prison, which to me makes it a much difficult movie to make, where it's like you have what was, you know, I think if you saw Historian in the News would think he's a despicable human being. But ultimately, does that man deserve redemption? Is it possible to have redemption? What does that mean? Can you make any good out of the horrible situation? Can you make any good out of? And I think that's kind of the theme that goes throughout this movie. It's also, you know, it's gorgeous where you have this, you know, desert landscape, which is open desert landscape. Ultimately, it all takes place in this confined prison. It's beautifully shot. The performance, there's two scenes in this that are two of my favorite scenes of the year. One about halfway through where he kind of confesses to his daughter, who is a character in the film as well, about what happened. And it's, it doesn't get you on his side, but I think it rounds him out as a character. Because you see him kind of struggling to kind of tame himself in a way, and just the difficulty of that happening. And then there's another sequence too, where it's, they have these therapy sessions, and they utilize a lot of, you know, actually, you know, former convicts or, you know, real life, you know, amateur actors. And they're asking, like, you know, what is the time frame from when you committed crime to, like, when you thought about it? Like, how much thinking went into the actual crime itself that landed you in prison for, you know, in some cases, decades? And, you know, it's like a minute, 30 seconds, no time at all. You just see, like, how just a moment can forever change someone's life in a way. So, you know, prison films for some reason tend to, like, start up a few years ago. It was one of my favorite movies right. of the year. Very different movie. That was a very tense, you know, kind of thrill ride in a way. This is more dramatic. And to me, asking kind of showing, like, the impact of kindness it can have on people, and small acts of that kindness. And I don't know. I found that to be kind of a very necessary thing to discuss in today's day and age. So that's why, and again, only watched it because we had Cinemax free for a week or something like that. And usually Cinemax doesn't have new movies, but this was on it. So I'm like, oh, let me check this out. The Mustang, it seemed like it'd be interesting. I watched the trailer, like, that seems up my alley, and ended up really enjoying it. You know, maybe if I had expectations, it wouldn't be as high. Like I said, may not be the film making level. But I do think the director for first feature was pretty incredible, especially one that's not, you know, the budget of something like Little Women or something like that. I think she has a great career ahead of her. I know it took like 5-6 years for her to make because of everything that went into it. But I don't know. I think as a first feature, I thought it was really, really incredible.
I mean, you sold me again. Another blind spot that I'll have to add to the list. I hadn't heard much about the Mustang over the course of the year, so definitely got me intrigued on that one as well. So I will check that one out. And Dan, I swear Cinemax had all kinds of movies when I was like 13. I'm just kidding.
Yes, very much so. A lot of those don't. I don't know if they'd make a best of year list, at least movie making wise. Yeah.
No. For my number two, it's probably what I would say was my favorite cinematic experience of the year. We went to this one with a large group of people. I want to say that we had at least, like, 6 to 10 people with us at this film, and it was just a ton of fun. Probably the most fun, maybe even one of the more rewatchable films I saw this year. And definitely had high expectations going in, and it lived up to those. I was a huge fan of Knives Out by Rian Johnson. I know it's a detective story, so I won't get into any details because not everybody has seen it. But I would just say that if they decided to have a series of films centered around one detective, Benoit Blanc, played by Daniel Craig, I would be all about it. And, like, you could just give me a film every few years, like a new story, just like they do with Sherlock Holmes or different people, Poirot or different, you know, whatever. Like, I will take as much of Daniel Craig in this role as you would like to give me. I thought he was hilarious. And the cast is just crazy. Like, I know a lot of people say Ana de Armas kind of steals it, but you get Chris Evans getting to do, you know, kind of show off a little bit of his acting outside of what we've gotten from the MCU. You got people like Michael Shannon, Jamie Lee Curtis, Don freaking Johnson. Frank Oz is in this, for God's sakes. So the cast is amazing. I thought it was a lot of fun. It's very funny. I know some people were like, somebody said something about, like, oh, you know, I knew what the deal was right from the beginning, or I'd figured it out. I'm like, you missed the point of the movie. Like, it is just a fun ride, and enjoy the performances, enjoy the dialogue, enjoy the craftsmanship that Rian Johnson is providing us. Like, regardless of if you do or don't figure it out, that could be like that was like the least of my concerns during this film. And I did not have it figured out. I wasn't even trying. I was just enjoying the ride. And I think this is a ride worth going on. So if you have not seen Knives Out, please go see it. I know I said that, Peanut Butter Falcon had some laughs. I know I said that The Dead Don't Die is probably the funniest movie of the year, but this one's got to be right up there too. This one's more than just funny though. Like, it's also enjoyable from a lot of other aspects. So I guess that's why I feel like Dead Don't Die is mainly just a straight comedy almost, whereas this one's not quite. But it is still hilarious. So I loved this film. I can't wait to watch it again. Knives Out by Rian Johnson, my number two film of the year. I know you haven't seen this one.
Yeah.
But please do.
Probably that and Uncut Gems are my biggest regrets of not seeing, unfortunately, but definitely see that.
I look forward to hearing your thoughts.
Yeah. My number two, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it because it's the best movie of the year, according to many, many people, including the Academy, and it is Parasite. Bong Joon-ho is a director that I've greatly enjoyed, you know, this overall this decade. Mother was actually my favorite film of 2010. I think I still like that a little bit more than Parasite, but they're both remarkable movies. Enjoyed The Host, Snowpiercer, and Okja as well. And it's hard to, like, you know, the phrase what more can be said about this movie that hasn't been is true. But I think the thing that always strikes me about pretty much every movie that Bong Joon-ho does is just his ability to manage tone in just wildly different tones throughout. That is showcased in Mother, when you have with two great bookend shots, as you see kind of how the movie begins and how it ends on this dancing sequence. And it just shows you the journey that you went through. And Parasite is very similar to that, where it's, you know, a comedy, it's a horror film, it's a suspense, it's everything. You know, it's ultimately just a film, you know, it's quote unquote cinema. And it certainly has a message that I think is very unique to South Korea, that there's probably a lot within that that, you know, as someone who's never been there or not as akin to that world, that I'm probably not picking up on. But I think there's a lot of universal aspects to what he is talking about as well. And it's just also just fun. Like, it's you talk about laughs. There's a lot of laughs. A lot of laughs where you feel bad, and almost laughs that turn into really horrible things, all within like moments of one another. And you know, it's weird. Rarely do we, I think, get a movie that is so universally enjoyed. I mean, every movie has naysayers, but I feel like this was one that, like, you know, one of the first times in a long time where it won Best Picture, and everyone's like, yeah, that's about right. Where the critic. You know, a lot of people lined up. So I've yet to meet someone who hates Parasite. I'm sure there's people out there, but right. I thought it was great. And again, when I was going into this, all I heard about was how amazing it was. And that's a lot to live up to.
Right.
And I would say it's probably the best main movie I saw all year, but this being my personal top 10 and movies that impacted me, still number two for me.
All right. So I'm interested to hear your number one. But yeah. Obviously I agree with Parasite. And I think it does say something about the film, you know, that it did finally crack, you know, through the Academy and, you know, have a foreign language film that was able to take away Best Picture is something that's huge. And I'm glad that it was, you know, Bong Joon-ho was part of that. So I don't say his name nearly as well as some people. So I apologize. My number one, like you said, with a bunch of these other ones, it may be not the best made film of the year, but I didn't really have any complaints. And I guess I'm just a sucker for this director because I've almost enjoyed everything he's ever done. And I know a lot of people were detractors on this. I know a lot of people have been detractors on a lot of his more recent films, but I am still on the bandwagon, I guess. I guess I'm a mark for Quentin Tarantino because Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is my number one film of the year. I do need to rewatch it. Maybe it would drop if I rewatched it again, but I enjoyed my entire experience with this film in the theater. I absolutely was enthralled with Brad Pitt's performance. I know a lot of people said he was better in Ad Astra, but I think he's amazing in this one as well. DiCaprio's good. Margot Robbie's good. I mean, there's just... I'm a sucker for dialogue. I'm a sucker for some of these commentaries that you're getting on this. I like the crazy take it is. I know a lot of people had a hard time because it's, you know, there is real types of events somewhat loosely depicted and you know, some people had a problem with that and how it was depicted and whatnot. But to me, it was a movie and I was viewing it as a movie. I'm not viewing it as a documentary. So, cause that's not what it was. And I just like Tarantino's style. I enjoyed this. It goes a bit off the rails and crazy and gruesome at times, but that's what you expect from Tarantino. So, I thoroughly enjoyed this. I don't know where it stacks for me in his filmography. It's not number one or two or anything like that, but it's probably in the top half. I, again, need to see it again, but I was surprised because I didn't have the expectations I normally do going into a Tarantino film. I wasn't necessarily expecting it to be, you know, a phenomenal film, but as I went out and went throughout the year, it's one that I could not stop thinking about as I kind of progressed throughout the rest of the year. And even though it was something that I saw, you know, midway through or whatever it was, it kept sticking with me. And I kept waiting for that film that I was going to watch that was going to dethrone that. You know, I thought, you know, once I see Parasite or once I see 1917 or once I see whatever, I'm sure it'll knock that out. And it just kept staying at that number one spot. So I do have some blind spots from the year, so that it still could get knocked out eventually. But for right now, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is still my number one film from last year. What about you, Dan?
Yeah, it just barely missed my top 10 at number 12. I have seen it twice, actually. It was one of the few movies I saw before getting the Best Picture Showcase. And, you know, we did the Quentin Tarantino retrospective. I'm a huge Quentin Tarantino fan. And I felt like this was very different from him in a lot of ways, just because it felt a little bit more, I don't know, not restrained than a lot of, especially compared to like something, you know, like his, something like Django Unchained that like is just an explosion of violence. This certainly has it, but like and you definitely see that kind of appreciation for a specific time and place that you're used to when it comes to Tarantino. But to me, it's a really great year when there's a Tarantino movie I've really enjoyed a great deal and it doesn't make my top 10.
Absolutely.
So I feel like I might get some hate for my number one. I'm not sure. Like I said, I'm not going to lie and say this is, I think it's the best movie of the year in the sense of, you know, filmmaking wise, or if I'm just going to do best compared to favorite. But as I talk expectations and how movies hit you, I think ultimately where I rank when it comes to this list. And I grew up in a very religious household as a kid. We didn't go to church once a week. We went three times a week. So on Sunday morning, Sunday night, and again on Wednesday. So as I've gotten older, not so much, but religion played a huge role in my life, especially since my parents certainly are there as well. And, you know, this was a huge year for Netflix, a lot of great movies, two films nominated for Best Picture. But ultimately, the movie that I enjoyed the most or had the biggest impact on me is The Two Popes, directed by Fernando Morales, who did City of God, which I know was hugely regarded movie. And I don't know why. Again, talking about expectations, I didn't have that many going into this. I thought, you know, let's see how this goes. But Jonathan Pryce, to me, gave me the best performance I saw all year. There's just a vulnerability to him throughout this entire film as you kind of learn about who he is and the life that, you know, Pope Francis lived before he became the actual Pope himself. Just that guilt that he has and why he didn't want to become Pope. As you learn that backstory. But I think too, one of the biggest reasons is, you know, growing up in that religious household, religion is like, these are the rules and this is it. Like there's no debating it. This is kind of the set standard of what you're told. And to me, it was just fascinating seeing which are like in a way walking deities discuss and debate elements of the very religion that they've dedicated their entire life to, which, you know, debates that could lead to huge changes throughout the Catholic religion. And then the ramifications of what that could mean throughout, just to me, it's like, wow, like just the biggest questions that for many have on life itself being kind of thrown back and forth. And I know there's some complaints that, you know, that it doesn't, that it's a little too fair to the Catholic Church. Doesn't really, I think, you know, especially when it comes to Pope Benedict, kind of have a harsh enough critique to him. And I think there, those complaints are legitimate. And it ultimately, it's two people talking. But to me, there's something surreal, too, about seeing legitimately two popes talking, eating pizza at like a restaurant. It's just, it's so weird. Or just watching a football game or soccer game together. It's just, it's, it is, you know, surreal, even though it's not really the, you know, the actual people themselves. That Anthony Hopkins is really good too. And I think Price though is just, I was just, I just felt like his pain, but also his generousness that come off the screen. Like I you know, I know him as an actor, but I never really, I think, truly appreciated what he was doing. He was just, to me, doing things far above. I know Joaquin Phoenix won for best actor, and I think he's a great actor. But looking at like the Joker performance compared to this, it's like night and day in the sense of, wow, this felt like a complete performance that had so much more to it. And I don't know, it really struck with me. Now I could watch this again in a week and like not nearly like it as much, or I definitely could see a year from now this not being my favorite film of the year, because I think there are a lot of legitimate issues with the film. But I think what it meant and the impact and what it just had me thinking of, it did that more so than any other movie this year, compared to like anything else I saw. So that's why it's my number one.
Interesting, because every time someone has asked me in the last month, like, oh, you probably saw all the films for Best Picture, and I'm always like, no, I haven't seen Little Women, and I always forget that Two Popes was nominated.
Because it wasn't nominated for Best Picture. It was just
just for like any of the awards. They're like, you know, I haven't seen all the ones for the main four categories or whatever, and I'm like, oh, I always forget that I haven't seen Two Popes. I grew up in a very religious family as well. We did go to church three times a week as well, and it was the same time, Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday. But it was a Baptist church, in which that's about as far from Catholic religion as you can get within, I guess, the Christian world. So things about the Pope and things about the Catholic Church have always just like never been on my radar. So I just kept forgetting that it was a film that was available for me to see. But I do like Jonathan Pryce and Anthony Hopkins, so I do want to see it, especially with all the award buzz. So I am looking forward to eventually seeing it. It was just one that always like was never on the radar as far as something that was like on my watch list. So
I could see it's also not worked for a lot of people, like I mentioned, because it's not a movie that's very flashy. The set designs are pretty remarkable, because they had to literally like recreate some of the greatest paintings ever made, even, you know, it just because they couldn't actually film on location. I just enjoyed just the topic of conversation for some reason. And again, that's where I know I talk about expectations a lot, but I think that plays a key role too when it comes to a lot of movies where, you know, I talk, you know, Parasite, like I couldn't top my expectations because but the Two Popes did, because I heard middling reviews for the most part, and perhaps I'm giving it more credit than it deserves. I don't know, but ultimately it's my list. I can do what I want. So
absolutely, it's my number one. You're a couple like that with the ones that you had the lower expectations with Little Women and the Two Popes. So
yeah, Little Women, I think, is probably, I think, you know, I think I can make a bigger argument for filmmaking wise. I feel like I'll get a lot of dismissive remarks when it comes to this for my number one, which is fine. Like I said, like in the, like I'm looking back at last year, I think, you know, my number one has already changed from that year. These are very fluid lists, but
absolutely
for now, that's where it's
at. I was glad to hear the case though that you made for both the Two Popes and a Little Woman, because like I said, there were two films that I was like, I wanted to see, but I wasn't really like, nothing was pushing me over the edge to see them. So I got a little bit more boost now to watch them in the next coming couple of weeks. So we're going to break down our top 10 real quickly, and then we'll get into a couple, you know, honorable mentions or films that we wanted to highlight that didn't quite make it. So my 10 through 1 is Ad Astra, Wild Rose, Peanut Butter Falcon, The Dead Don't Die, 1917, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, Parasite, The Irishman, Knives Out, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Dan?
My number 10 is Tell Me Who I Am. Avengers Endgame. Number 8 is Farewell. 1917. Number 6 is The Nightingale. 5, Apollo 11. 4 is Little Women. 3, The Mustang. 2, Parasite. And number 1, The Two Popes.
All right, Dan, what about any
numbers in them, which just makes it more confusing?
Yes, it does. What about any films that you don't necessarily have to read them all off, but any way you want to do it, any highlights of names that you would like to mention from films that didn't quite make it?
So Tell Me Who I Am just knocked off Jojo Rabbit, which was my number 10. I had a streak going there for a Taika Waititi movie, made my top 10 for a few years in a row, but just really made it. I really enjoyed Jojo Rabbit a lot. That also hit me an emotional level I was not expecting.
I was also not expecting that to be as serious as it was at times. I thought it would be much more slapstick, much more comedy. Not that it didn't have that, but I was like, oh, we're hitting the feels now.
Yeah. We brought up Shia LaBeouf in this episode, and Honey Boy, I thought was quite good, which was written by him and basically his life story. I thought that was, again, showing how great of a, I think, performance he can be, actor he can be, and it's loaded with good performances. Speaking of Netflix films, I also did really enjoy, not the right word, but Marriage Story. That was, again, another difficult watch, but
yeah.
I do love Noah Baumbach, and I probably like some of his other films a little bit more, but I'm glad it's getting the praise it is. The Last Black Man in San Francisco, you mentioned Ad Astra. Some other documentaries that came out, Hail Satan, which is the Two Popes and Hail Satan coming out not that long ago, but which is a great documentary, really just about this group that it's kind of trolls slash kind of political activists. I thought was interesting. The Amazing Jonathan documentary. There's actually a bunch of Amazing Jonathan documentaries, which the Amazing Jonathan documentary gets into. I think it's kind of a messy film that doesn't answer a lot of its own questions, but just as this crazy story, it's worth watching. But yeah, I'm trying to think of other films. I think it's pretty much it. Like I said, there's a lot I've yet to see. But how about you for honorable mentions?
A couple that you mentioned, Marriage Story was my number 11. Just missed. Amanda refused to watch that one with me, but I watched it solo. But I, again, totally driven by performances and by, I really enjoy films with limited casts that just kind of really delve into their relationships. And obviously you get a lot of that from A Marriage Story, and avoided some of the cliche aspects that could have gone down. So I enjoyed that. This has got to be a testament to this film that I didn't hate it, because I'm not a fan of films about cars. I'm not a fan of films about racing, but Ford v Ferrari worked for me enough that it's in my top 20 as well. So just wanted to mention that. So other ones I had in there, I thought there was a lot of films this year that delved into families and kind of the journey that the teenagers or the high schoolers or whatever in those families are having. Two that came to mind that kind of worked for me was Loose and Waves. I think both of those are interesting. I could see how they might not work for some people, but definitely delving into the story of teenagers, and kind of goes back to like what you were talking about with Mustang, where the thing that really kind of I gravitated towards with both of these films was how much one decision or one circumstance or being in the certain place at the certain time just can completely change the shape of these individuals' lives, and completely set them on a different course one way or the other. I don't know which one I liked better than the other, but I thought they were both intriguing and interesting to kind of see that aspect of like, wow, this one thing. Now, obviously Loose kind of goes off the rails a little bit and it's got some craziness to it, whereas Waves is a lot more grounded in probably more reality. And I do like the other thing about Waves is that it kind of, there's a transition into almost like the second half of the film that I very much appreciated too, and kind of add some layers and elements. So I definitely recommend Waves if people haven't seen it. Kind of speaking to my sci-fi bug there, I did enjoy High Life quite a bit. It's another one that's kind of takes, you got to get past some parts and stuff that you're not going to forget that happened in that film. But I think what really sold that one for me was that last act. And I thought it was something, again, that left you with some stuff to ponder and think about. I already mentioned Teen Spirit and her smell. I agree with you, Dan, on Jojo Rabbit. It didn't quite make my top 10, like a lot of other YTD stuff has, but I still thought it was very enjoyable. I didn't have any idea what we were getting involved with that one, but it definitely took me in some areas that I wasn't anticipating. Outside of that, I did enjoy Yesterday. It was kind of a clever take and thing. I mean, I know it's very, I don't know what the right word is, but I just thought it was expertly crafted in a way to do what the director and the writers wanted to do. Whether it worked for you or not, I don't know, but like, I enjoyed the journey and kind of the way they played it around all the musical thing. And it's kind of an interesting concept, as far as having a world where the Beatles didn't exist and kind of the ramifications of one person knowing their songs. And then the last ones I probably mentioned, Dragged Across Concrete from way early on. I count that as this year's film, was something that I remember enjoying early on. That's probably good for right now. So those are other ones that I would recommend that are probably in my top 20, 30 range. But I will be putting out a list on Letterboxd as well that has my complete list of all the films I've seen in order of my appreciation. Not that that matters to anybody, but I like putting it out there for my own peace of mind. So, and Dan, I know you have a lot of lists on Letterboxd that people can check out as well. Overall, we said it was a good year. I think we both agree with that. A lot of good things to choose from, and that's with both of us having quite a few blind spots as well that we still need to catch up with. Any final thoughts on the year in film in 2019?
No, like I said, it's still a lot I need to watch. I do feel like when we have so many movies, it's like impossible to have a bad year. Now I say that, and then as I was looking to 2020, as we get ready for Most Anticipated, and I'm like, wow, this is going to be a lot more difficult than I anticipated. Looking a little dry, but still early. You never know. You know, there's still a lot it's like a lot of these movies that I think majority of them that were on my list weren't even on my most anticipated for 2019. So that's always a good sign. So right. We'll see.
And some of them we never even know about until all of a sudden it's like, hey, this is a thing.
Exactly. Especially when it comes to like documentaries or the smaller movies that you kind of that maybe. Yeah, debuted in some small festival in a town and then gets picked up or something like that. So
yeah, absolutely. So Dan and I are going to try to get back in the swing of things here for everybody, bringing you some, hopefully some semi-regular episodes of Cinema Geeks. I know we're excited to do some of the stuff that we usually do at the beginning of the year, talking about box office, talking about most anticipated films. And then we'll probably get into the thing that, you know, everybody is doing, which is looking back at the last decade and the movies of the 2010s and what kind of stood out to us. We did a mid-year series of episodes back when we had just been through the first 5 years of the decade, and we talked about our favorite action films of the half decade and favorite, you know, different genres and things of that nature, sci-fi, fantasy, etc. And we're looking forward to doing something similar to that to bring you guys the whole story now that we've reached the end of all 10 years. So any thoughts on some of those things you're looking forward to talking about coming forward?
Yeah, I'm interested in seeing like how much they've changed compared, you know, looking at some of them like from the 2015 to now, like how much has changed in that 5 years.
Right.
It's really hard because you think, you know, doing 10 movies for 1 year is hard enough. But when you try to then do it for a decade, you're like, oh, Jesus, this is 10's not clearly enough. But that I'm really looking forward to. So.
And hopefully we'll be able to bring a couple of guest voices along for the journey through that like we did originally. So so that's it for this. Let us know what your thoughts and your takes are on our top 10 films of 2019. You can let us know by going to geekcastradio.com and finding the episode post and commenting there. You can also let us know directly by interacting with us on Twitter. My Twitter is @OptimusSolo. Dan, what is yours?
A lot has changed since the last time we talked, including my Twitter handle, which is now @DXO_Dan. So
and you can also tweet to the show @CinemaGeekCast. We had to add the cast on there to get the Twitter handle, so you can do that. But we look forward to talking to you guys more and getting back in the game. So until next time, tune in for another episode of the Cinema Geeks.